Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonpartisan nonprofit organization. I'm Lindsay Lingholz, Senior Director for Policy and Program here at ACS. This spring, insurrection is on the Supreme Court's docket, with three cases and one additional action that all arise out of litigants seeking accountability for the violent events of January 6, 2021. This month, the court will hear argument in two cases, Fisher versus United States and Trump versus United States, that come to the court in the context of criminal prosecutions. Today, we are going to look back at how the court handled the first insurrection case, a civil case, on its docket this term, Trump versus Anderson. Regular listeners of Broken Law will be very familiar with this case, but those who are joining us for the first time, or it's been a while, you likely know this case by its headline, the Trump ballot disqualification case. The court issued its decision last month, and here to help us dig in on the decision and what it means for the project of accountability is Donald Sherman. Donald is the Executive Vice President and Chief Counsel at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, affectionately known as CRU. Before joining CRU, he served in various oversight, ethics, and policy roles in the executive branch and Congress, including the White House, the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, the House Ethics Committee, and the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. Donald, welcome back to Broken Law.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Oh, we're delighted to have you back and here to talk about what we've been talking about for several episodes now. We get to see how it came out and where we go from here. So I want to start with the basics for folks who maybe saw the headlines but didn't read much further, which I know I've been accused of in the past before, or the news that has faded from their memory because it's been a few weeks now. What is an issue in Trump versus Anderson, and what did the court end up deciding?
So the issue in Trump v. Anderson was whether the Colorado Supreme Court erred in removing former President Trump from Colorado's Republican primary ballot based on his disqualification under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The result was we pretty much got our teeth kicked in. We lost technically 9-0. All of the justices agreed that states do not have authority to enforce Section 3 against federal candidates and federal office holders. But there was quite a number of distinctions between what all of the justices agreed on and then what a majority, a 5-member conservative male majority agreed on in terms of how to proceed. Specifically, although, you know, the finding that states don't have authority to enforce Section 3 without explicit legislation from Congress authorizing them to do so was enough to dispose of our case, the majority went further in a couple of ways. One was moderately helpful and most were unhelpful.
Shocking from this court.
So the court said that states have the authority to enforce Section 3 against state office holders, which was confirmed when the court declined cert in our other Section 3 case, White versus Griffin, or I guess Griffin versus White, since we also won that one, and Griffin appealed to SCOTUS. And, you know, I think the interesting thing there is nothing in the text of Section 3 makes either the distinction that was helpful to us or the distinction that ultimately led to us losing Trump v. Anderson, right? Section 3 makes no distinction between enforcement against federal officials versus state officials. And it's one of the ways that I think the majority fell down. But the court also made clear that there's no mechanism to enforce Section 3 in courts against federal officers without Congress passing legislation to do so. And so it left open a number of different questions, including, you know, whether Congress can enforce Section 3 against members of Congress, since they have, you know, explicit authority in the Constitution to assess the qualifications of the members of their respective bodies. And, you know, I think there are lingering questions about what is Congress's appropriate role and whether Section 3 can be enforced during the certification process, which, as you know, many amici noted, is a disastrous punt because it puts a target on Congress on January 6th, much in the same way that Donald Trump did that when he refused to accept the results of the 2020 presidential election. And so, and you know, it also sort of included this warning that, well, even if Congress does pass legislation, that it would still be subject to review by the court and have to meet the strictures of City of Bernie. So sort of this punt, but an ominous punt, suggesting that, hey, yes, Congress can do this, but also we're going to have our say if Congress decides to pass enforcing legislation. And so, you know, in many ways, it was really sort of a stick in the eye of Section 3, which I can get into in greater detail later. And then there are also two concurrences, one from Justice Coney Barrett, who was essentially saying, we've agreed on this small thing. I don't know why we need to say, why the majority needs to say more than that. Also, I don't like that the other concurring justices use certain language in their concurrence.
Pearls were clutched in the concurrence.
I mean, you could see it, and you know, and yeah, feelings were hurt, I guess. I don't know. And then, you know, the three ostensibly liberal justices on the court wrote a more pointed concurrence, which maybe was a dissent at some point. Who knows? Metadata is weird. And said, you know, in more pointed terms, and, you know, started by quoting Chief Justice Roberts and Dobbs, and said, look, we all agree on one thing, and that was sufficient to dispose this case. There's no need to go further. And that essentially you have left this country without any mechanism to enforce Section 3 against oath-breaking insurrectionists who's seeking the nation's highest office. And so, you know, while I guess I appreciated some of that, you know, I think all nine of them got it wrong. And, you know, I can tell you all about that if you want.
Let's talk a little bit about it, because I think to me, especially listening to oral argument, what was so interesting was it seemed like at least some of the justices came in with the answer that they wanted and then kind of fished around for a justification. And a lot of that fishing looked like just talking about federalism, but just kind of the vibes of federalism. It wasn't like grounded in particular concepts. I mean, obviously federalism as a whole, but you know, as an election law person, I can tell you that there's a number of things that the states all decide on their own when it comes to administering elections, being the primary source of kind of dictating how those things go. And so it was a little bit through the looking glass listening to oral argument of like, oh God, we can't let states have an impact on how this turns out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was frustrating. I mean, look, the oral argument, I think once Justice Brown Jackson, started asking questions that seemed a bit ahistorical, you know, it was like, okay, this is going to be a tougher road to hoe than, you know, even we expected walking in. And I think once Jason Murray, our oral advocate, got up, I mean, you know, it was clear that the justices were hot and hostile, which I think is something that I didn't fully anticipate. But yeah, you know, I think the justices got a lot of things wrong and inconsistent, and it, you know, it was inconsistent with the text and the history and the original meaning of Section 3. Also, just inconsistent with, you know, our lived experience. The questions about, oh my God, how could a single state decide an election? And you know, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm sorry, I lived through 2020. I've, you know, been alive for 43 years, and every election that I've participated in, every presidential election that I've participated in, with the exception, I think, of 2004 and 2012, really sort of hinged on like one state or a couple of states. And, you know,
even 04 had Ohio where it was, but yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, some of these justices worked on Bush v. Gore as lawyers. So it just felt wildly inconsistent. And then you think about federalism and you know, where the court has been with respect to the sweeping power of states and the fact that for the entirety of, you know, at least the last century, states have overseen federal elections, including elections for president, and not every candidate has been on the ballot. And so, you know, it just really seemed outcome determinative, and not that, oh my God, how could a state block a candidate for president from office, which happens often, has happened last cycle, happened this cycle, happened when Gorsuch ruled in the Hassan case that Colorado could keep Hassan off the ballot. But it was that Trump is a leading candidate and a popular candidate and a former president. And, you know, that was his whole argument from the start, that the law should not apply to me because I am special, because people like me, and that I am above the law because, you know, I have a 40% block of the American electorate that would be angry if I am not on the ballot, which I am not aware of any legal jurisprudence that supports the idea that popularity is a metric for application of the United States Constitution. I mean, that's not why we have a constitution. And in particularly Section 3, right? We have Section 3 precisely because the concern of a popular figure being elected to president of the United States, a popular insurrectionist being elected president. And so, you know, I heard Gerard Magliocca at Indiana say this the other day. You know, he said he thought that the decision was disrespectful of Section 3. And I agree. And, you know, I think one of the briefs that, you know, there were a lot of briefs filed and none were cited, and, you know, that's fine. But, you know, I think one of the briefs that I found most compelling was the brief by historians. It was led by Jill Lepore at Harvard and, you know, really, and, you know, wrote about the history of Section 3. And I think people forget the cost, right? Hundreds of thousands of Americans died to restore our union. And out of that, this Congress, this Reconstruction Congress, ratified the 14th Amendment, including Section 3, and basically strong-armed the Southern states to ratify Section 3 as the cost of re-entering the Union, right? That cost something. It cost our nation a great deal. Stepping forward to bring this litigation cost our clients something, cost them their personal safety. Judge Wallace, who ruled in Trump's favor, was getting threats. And certainly the justices at the Colorado Supreme Court ruled in our favor. You know, one of them got swatted after this decision. And I felt like the court's treatment of Section 3 and of this case was disrespectful to what our forebears and what the folks involved in getting this litigation to the court risked on behalf of the Constitution and on behalf of our union. And so, like, the decision just was atextual, it was ahistorical, and, you know, didn't even answer all of the questions that needed to be answered if the court wanted to succeed in making it a dead issue. And, you know, most importantly, it didn't exonerate Donald Trump of engaging in insurrection. And so I'm sort of left with the place where I think we walked in, which is every fact finder that has reached the merits of the question of whether January 6th was an insurrection said that it was, including the New Mexico court said that it was an insurrection. And every court or tribunal or fact finder that had the courage to reach the merits of the decision found that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection in violation of his oath. And the court did not disturb that. Maybe they're too afraid to go there, but they went other places that were unnecessary to go to resolve the case. And so it's weird that if they wanted to exonerate Trump, then they should have stepped up and done so. I'd have been salty about that too. But at least I, you know, with the benefit of some hindsight, I probably would have respected that more than what seemed like an inartful dodge in what we got in the decision.
Inartful is such a good word. As I was reading the majority opinion and the insistence that came through of, like, we're just trying to provide clarity. We're trying to provide clarity to the process. And there's 8 new questions that arose that I'll tell you that I'm on a couple different, you know, email listservs of election folks from across the spectrum. And it was off and popping that day because everybody's like, I don't actually know. I don't know if this means Congress can do this after votes are count. I don't know if this means that they have to wait until January 6th, 2025, or if it can be done before, if it's individual specific, or if it's abroad. Like, it asks more questions than it answers to a lot of folks, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, again, this court has said repeatedly that consequences and chaos are not like its concern, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we saw that in a number of cases that were decided that were very much in conflict with where the majority of Americans are, Dobbs being one of them. And so then to have the justices openly sort of question chaos, mm-hmm. you know, at oral argument, and then render a decision that does not answer questions that could have avoided chaos is also just wildly disappointing. I think one thing that was sort of hard to navigate at oral argument is how do you wrestle, and the justices did not want to touch this, but how do you wrestle with the fact that Trump is an adjudicated insurrectionist? That is, again, undisturbed, that factual finding, though Trump is suing in Maine to try and get it wiped from the history books. How do you wrestle with leaving that decision unresolved? How do you, and like, what is the chaos that potentially comes? Again, if that question gets raised on January 6th, or that question gets raised by his opponent in the race. Again, you know, the court had an opportunity to answer this issue with clarity and finality. And I think the simplest and most correct thing would have been for to rule in our favor. But even in ruling against us, they could have, the five of them that were in the, you know, ostensible majority, could have reached a decision that would have answered most of these questions. And they just sort of face planted, and I assume are just sort of hoping it all works out, right? But mm-hmm. if they had at least had the courage to say what I think some of them suggested, which is that, well, we don't think January 6th is an insurrection, right? Then we would have an answer. And so it's just, it was frustrating because they overreached, but also underreached and failed at yeah. both. And so, you know. I think the questions are going to remain.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation. What did you make of the kind of fault lines amongst the justices? You know, the majority opinion, we keep referring to the majority opinion because it was per curiam, because we don't technically yeah. know who wrote it. And as you mentioned, I want to, for folks who maybe aren't as in the weeds on this, you mentioned the metadata that came out, some internet sleuths possibly determined that there was some metadata in the concurrence from the liberal justices that maybe it was a dissent at one point. To me, the Barrett concurrence was trying to give the veneer of like, this is unanimous, it's fine, we're unanimous, when it really didn't seem like they were unanimous amongst themselves, maybe yeah. on paper and in result, but not in reasoning.
Yes. I mean, that's exactly right. And again, I don't think that the liberal justices reached the right result, because I think even their conclusion and the distinction between how Section 3 can be enforced against state officers versus federal officers is not in the text anywhere. It's not tethered to text or history. But, you know, I think Justice Roberts, understandably, wanted the decision to be unanimous and wanted to sort of tout it as being unanimous. And I think I think that was probably a bridge too far for the liberal justices. Again, I mean, we are talking about someone who the nation saw engage in insurrection. And so the idea that like you're just going to sort of write this technical decision that lets Trump off the hook without even deigning to acknowledge the threat that January 6th posed to our republic is, you know, I think was a bridge too far. And the fact that they attempted, the majority did, to make damn sure that this issue with respect to Trump never came back to the Supreme Court. That was the thing that they tried. I don't think they succeeded, but I think everybody acknowledges, and I think the concurrence did so in fairly scathing fashion, that's what's going on here. Like, you overreach because you're like, look, I don't want you jokers in Colorado or at Crew or anywhere, you know, anywhere else thinking that Section 3 is going to come back to us before this election is resolved. And I think it's fine for them to think that, but you know, but how they wrote the majority decision leaves too many open questions to have any idea whether it's going to present again or not, to say nothing of it. It leaves us vulnerable to future insurrections, right? I mean, this is, and like, I'm not a political person. I'm not a political expert, but like Trump has put January 6th front and center. And so the idea that if he loses, that he won't try to engage in a similar effort to obstruct the peaceful transfer of power or the continued or the certification process, it seems unlikely that Trump is just going to accept the results of the election this time around. As I often like to point out, he questioned the results of an election he won.
Yep. And has been consistent. I will give him that. He has been consistent the whole way through.
Right. He is totes on brand.
If I win, it wasn't by enough. If I lose, it's completely invalid. And y'all just got to find me some votes to make that case for me.
Yeah. And, you know, like the man can't take a win.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like, it's interesting because, you know, after the trial court, it was funny because he won.
Yeah.
And we appealed the one issue that we lost, and he cross appealed the 10 issues that he lost. And, you know, as I said, even now, even though Secretary Bellows in Maine issued, like, modified her order to make clear that Trump could be on the ballot, that wasn't enough for him. And he wants to rewrite history as well to vacate her findings that he engaged in insurrection. And, you know, maybe he's going to try and wipe from the internet what Mitch McConnell said in the aftermath of January 6th and then in 2022, calling January 6th an insurrection. But, you know, there's not enough legal process in the world for us to forget what we saw on January 6th and in the lead up to that. And, you know, Donald Trump is an adjudicated insurrectionist. He will be so in the history books, regardless of whether he gets to stay on the ballot or not.
I want to ask about the silver lining, which we've alluded to a few times, and the state actions that can be brought against state actors.
Sure.
You mentioned the recent decision from the Supreme Court to not grant cert in the Griffin case. Can you remind us what the Griffin case is and kind of how that came about?
Sure. So the Griffin case is the first successful trial to enforce Section 3 in 155 years. We brought that case on behalf of three New Mexico residents against Cowboys for Trump founder Coy Griffin, who breached police barriers on January 6th, was part of the mob. He did not enter the Capitol, but he was outside of the Capitol riling up the crowd. And before that, he spent weeks traveling from New Mexico to D.C. by car, recruiting people to come to D.C. And engage in violence, including a really damning video that I was grateful that he put on the internet for the world to see, where he said, I want people to come to D.C., but I want men. I want men to come to D.C. because when you're in there for battle, you know, you want to be standing shoulder to shoulder with men. And then you could see him chanting heave ho as the mob was coordinating, trying to break through the tunnel doors at the Capitol. And, you know, on the trial that we put on against Griffin, you know, it was just really sort of gripping juxtaposition between that chant which you can hear when Danny Hodges, one of the witnesses that testified in our case, is being crushed in the tunnel. And Griffin, again, inexplicably, recorded a call with a reporter the next day, bragging about how he was out there chanting "Heave Ho" and how he could see the scrum at the, you know, at the front of the Capitol. And so he was disqualified in September of 2022. He botched his appeal at the state court level, which made for a ineffective vehicle to appeal to the Supreme Court, but he appealed nonetheless for reasons. But, you know, in Anderson, the court was explicit that states can enforce Section 3 against state officials, and then denying cert to Griffin sort of was the, exclamation point at the end of that period. And so there aren't that many people where the facts and the available evidence are as significant as there were against Mr. Griffin and Mr. Trump, but certainly there is a possibility that there are other state actors who are running for state office or state office holders who also violated their oath by participating in the January 6th insurrection and can and should be subject to disqualification.
I'm curious, as you step back and look at kind of the result in Trump versus Anderson, the big takeaways, how should we be thinking about accountability and insurrection going forward, given what the court has done and given the multiple other institutions that the court has kind of kept in it?
Yeah.
How do we go forward from here?
So I think my personal takeaway is bringing accountability, particularly in this climate, is hard, but it is worth doing. I am so grateful to our clients, you know, Norma Anderson, who's 91 years old, the former Republican majority and minority leader in the Colorado House and Senate, the first woman to hold those positions, and, you know, an absolute badass. And, you know, our other really brave clients who looked at the Constitution, looked at what happened on January 6th and said, no, this is a bridge too far. And, you know, as somebody who's studied the history in the aftermath of the Civil War and looked at the case law enforcing Section 3 and looked at the debates about Section 3, our democracy is made up of institutions, but institutions are made up of people, and people have to stand up. And I am glad that our clients and the judges, including Judge Wallace, who ruled against us, and including the justices on the Colorado Supreme Court who ruled in our favor, you know, were willing to wrestle with these tough issues, and Judge Matthew in New Mexico wrestle with these tough issues and make hard choices, because, you know, this litigation is less about the 2024 election and more about whether we will have free and fair elections on a going forward basis, whether my children will continue to live in a country that has free and fair elections, and whether their children will live in a country that has free and fair elections. I worked for Elijah Cummings, the late Elijah Cummings, who would often say, our work is on behalf of generations yet unborn, right? And that's in part how I see this work. It's also interesting because we had an amicus brief submitted on behalf of children, which just made the point that the 14th Amendment has to endure, not just for this current moment, but for future generations. And so, one, I hope that the story of Section 3 and how it can be utilized to address this moment in history is not done. I think that, you know, it will take a little bit longer to get the accountability that I think Section 3 and that I think deserves and that, you know, I think January 6th merits, but we and others are prepared to do that work. But I also think that Jack Smith is going to move forward when, you know, what's going to happen in Georgia with the Georgia prosecution. I need people to remember that there was a trial. Donald Trump has been put on trial for his conduct related to January 6th. We did that. And he was found to have engaged in insurrection. And so, you know, I'm never not going to be proud of that. And I think history will record that. And I'm going to damn well make sure that it does. Because what I don't want is if, God forbid, we are in a similar moment, 50, 100, 150 years from now, that If, you know, some lawyer or some person sort of looking back for guidance on how to proceed, that there is a clear public record from these cases, from our work, that provides a guidepost. You know, I always sort of viewed our job is to get this issue to SCOTUS. History is going to judge what they did with it. And I don't think that they will be judged well based on how they treated this issue.
I want to ask one final question, which is just for folks who are particularly interested, have been following along, who, as they watch the next trials, what can they do to learn more? We'll make sure that we include links to the two amicus briefs you've mentioned so far, the historians and the children's brief, but anywhere else that folks can really dig in, either on the history or on the theory, what resources would you point folks to?
Yeah, I mean, so certainly come to our website, citizensforethics.org. One of the things that we have been pretty intentional about is like putting our evidence up on the website. So there's robust treatment of the docket in Griffin, as well as the docket in Anderson. I would look at the Anderson docket on the Supreme Court's website, and all you have to do is type into Google Trump v. Anderson docket. It'll come up and you'll see, I mean, just wildly compelling and impressive briefs from, you know, historians, from civil rights lawyers like Sherrilyn Ifill, from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund as well, from Republican governors like Governor Roscoe, who was a former RNC chair. And then honestly, most of Trump's amicus briefs were from partisans. And so you'll also sort of see just the sort of difference in perspective and weight. And, you know, I think that will give you a sense of how this case got here, how this issue sort of developed through the courts. My hope is that, you know, organizations like the National Constitution Center and others will tell the story of this case. But I mean, you know, we talked about this before we went on online, but it's one of the reasons why I felt it was important to talk to law students and really talk to anybody sort of about this case and how it got here, because I think the story of accountability for January 6th is one that is continuing to be told. And, you know, we should look at what the court does with the immunity case that's coming before it in April and these prosecutions to see if they get up off the ground. But like, history is still being written in this moment. And so I think people should pay attention and, you know, fight for the truth, which is frankly, is a fight that, you know, is hard to imagine that has to be had. But, you know, Trump is like right now trying to rewrite history. And so just like telling and documenting the truth is probably, I think, the best way to make sure that there's accountability for this moment.
Anything that I haven't asked that you want to make sure that we lift up?
You know, you mentioned the immunity case. And I think one through line is that, at least with respect to Trump, he continues to make the argument that he is above the law, that he cannot be held accountable. I mean, you saw this even in oral argument with Jonathan Mitchell, who, when he was asked a question about whether 2383, 18 U.S.C. 2383, the criminal insurrection statute, was the only mechanism that could be used to hold a federal office holder accountable for engaging in insurrection, he acknowledged its validity, but then quickly pivoted to, but also Donald Trump is immune from criminal prosecution. And so Donald Trump does not want to be held accountable. And he believes that because he served as president once, and because, you know, he is popular among a certain segment of the population, that he is immune to any sort of legal accountability. And that would be a disastrous course of action for our country, right? We made the choice to eschew a monarchy. Like that issue I thought was decided in 1776. But, you know, Donald Trump wants us to believe that the presidency is essentially without any check and balances. And then the other thing is, you know, the other case that's before SCOTUS this term is about obstruction of official proceeding. And again, I think it is an attempt for J6 sympathizers to try and rewrite history and, you know, make the case that January 6th wasn't as bad as people thought and that, you know, there shouldn't be accountability. And, you know, I'm left sort of thinking that for better or for worse, it might have been useful for DOJ to take a harder look at charging somebody with 2383. But, you know, it's just really disappointing the effort in real time for January 6th sympathizers to sort of erase it from our memory. And, you know, we see this with, you know, the Confederacy and Confederate monuments and things. But even then, that, like, that turn did not happen as quickly as it's happening now, right? Like, it took a while, but it was almost, you know, I think for some office holders and for some courts, it's just like, well, maybe if we don't talk about it, it'll go away. Maybe if we don't talk about it, like, we can move forward. And you can't move forward as a nation without reckoning with the trauma that our nation experienced, with the threat that Donald Trump and the insurrection and insurrectionists pose to our nation. We learned that from the Civil War. And it is unfortunate that we still have to work to relearn those lessons from January 6th.
Donald, thank you so much. This has been incredibly interesting, but also I'm just so grateful for your time and your insight, because y'all have been keeping this issue at the forefront for so long. And I want to thank you both for being on today, but also just the work that you are doing and that truth telling. And so thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thank you, Lindsay. I will tell you, you know, working on this case, working on this issue, maybe the most important thing I do in my professional life, and certainly representing these clients has been the honor of my professional life.
Oh, well, thank you to you. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. If you want to make sure that you don't miss an episode, please subscribe. That will help you and us tremendously. If you're enjoying the show, help us bring it to others by giving us a 5-star review and recommending Broken Law to a friend. If you have ideas for future episodes, please let us know. You can email us at podcast@acslaw.org or find us on social media @acslaw. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interest it really serves, inclusive discourse.